Welcome to the Battle Archive. Since 2005, the Academy of Ideas has organised the Battle of Ideas Festival, with debates on the key cultural, political and scientific issues of the day. We are proud to be the home for unfettered debate, the People's Parliament, the place where new ideas come alive in open discussion. And now, we are opening our vault, making our recordings of public debate available to you, free to revisit and share as often as you like. For more free speech content and news on our next festival, subscribe below or head to academyofideas.org.uk. But for now, enjoy the discussion.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for coming. I know there was a very busy session on the election just kicking off at lunchtime when I'm hot off the presses, so I know there's lots of people at that. So there'll be some more people joining us, but it's time to kick off. I'm Jacob Reynolds. I'm the Partnerships Manager at the Academy of Ideas. I've been intimately involved in running the battle, and I've been producing the keynotes for the weekend, this being the semi-final one. So I think it's gone all right so far, so I just have to not let us fall down at the semi-final hurdle. So, and I'm sure the panel will help me do that. We're going to be talking for the next hour and a half about the crisis of trust in institutions. And really, we could have put almost any part of the title in scare quotes, because part of one of the things we definitely want to address is, like, in what institutions, what crisis, what do we mean by trust? So there's an awful lot to unpick, but it's really been trust and its absence has really been a recurring theme in both the keynotes, but also in almost every session I've been to this weekend. There was a session yesterday on the supposed fall of the mainstream media, and there's questions about whether people can trust the media anymore. There's the superficial sort of political questions of whether people can trust politicians, and lots of people say, oh, I can't trust Boris Johnson after he broke his pledge not to get Brexit done by the 31st of October. Do we trust? There's questions about trust. Do we trust the medical advice we receive? There's a big issue, obviously, in the States around at the moment about vaping, and is vaping dangerous, and is the information that's being given out there accurate? And can we trust opinion polls? And what in a more volatile age, where are the sort of stable things that people can look to? Look for trust. It's also, although we're steering clear as much as we can of the B word, it isn't Boris, but Brexit, is that obviously there's a populist element to the discussion around trust, and lots of people saying that the breakdown in trust, if there is one, is in part and parcel either caused by or a representation of the political forces that led people to question the establishment, which we had a whole keynote on yesterday. This question of trust is often presented as a question of knowledge. So are they telling the truth? But it's also, I think, and one of the things we want to unpick, it's an important political question, which is what is the relationship of the people who are claiming that I should trust them to me? So it's not just a question of knowledge or facts, but also sometimes a question of power. So what we want to dig into for this hour and a half, what are the causes of this breakdown of trust, if there is indeed a breakdown? Is it a real breakdown in trust? How does it relate, as I say, to this populist moment? What are the consequences of a breakdown in trust? So to tackle this, we've got a really wonderful panel to help us pick through it. So I'm going to introduce them in the order that they're going to speak. Speaking first, on my immediate right, is Miranda Green, who's a journalist and commentator, the deputy editor of the opinion pages at the Financial Times, and a former Liberal Democrat advisor. Speaking next is Simon Wesley, who's Regius Chair of Psychiatry at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience at King's College London, and President of the Royal Society of Medicine. Also, like a lot of the panelists on this on today, a great friend and contributor to the Battle of Ideas over the years. We're really grateful to have Simon with us.
I never learn, do I?
Then speaking third will be Linda Woodhead, who's Distinguished Professor of Religion and Society at Lancaster University, author of That Was the Church That Was, How the Church of England Lost the English People. people. That short bio doesn't nearly do justice to the degree to which Linda Woodhead is very much the go-to most eminent commentator on all things religious in the UK and beyond. So we're really, really grateful to have Linda with us. Then speaking fourth, we have a slightly late addition to the panel, but really delighted to have him, is John Waters, who's an Irish newspaper columnist, the author of Jiving at the Crossroads, Was It for This, and Why Ireland Lost the Plot, and Give Us Back the Bad Roads. Then rounding us off will be Dr. Tim Black, who's the books and essays editor at the online magazine Spike. So as I say, a really great panel to help us unpick this. Can we give them a warm welcome? So as we're well into Sunday of the Battle of Ideas, I hope you all now know how this will work. The panelists will have 5 to 7 minutes to present their opening thoughts, a time I will be as strict as I can about. And after that, we will get into the discussion, maybe a question from me. But most importantly, this is a chance for us to unpick these issues together in public and start a genuine public conversation. That's the ethos of the Battle of Ideas. You can, if you can multitask, unlike me, you can double team that conversation with a conversation online using hashtag Battle of Ideas Fest. But you'll keep your attention firmly focused on the panel. So without any further from me, I'll hand over to Miranda to kick us off.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm sharing this microphone with Tim, but I hope you can all hear me at the back. So I was delighted to be invited to take part in this discussion because it's obviously only a tiny topic, crisis of trust in our institutions, as we're going through this very tumultuous time, not just in the UK, we should remember, but across Europe, across all the Western democracies, and a sort of time for re-evaluating who feels they have a stake, why that's not everyone, and what we should do about it, which seems to me to be the nub of this question. So I would, in a sense, agree with our essay question that there is a crisis of trust. And in fact, sort of journalistically, having commissioned and written a lot of things on this theme over the last few days, I sort of have in my mind the visual image that we once commissioned to illustrate one of these pieces, which is sort of, you know, the pillars holding something up, wobbling, some of them actually starting to shatter and some of them already being on the ground. And I think that's a kind of, you know, useful way to visualise what it feels that we're living through, which that can at times feel like a kind of democratic earthquake. And, you know, clearly, as our chair has quite rightly said, the main sort of topic under debate in the UK at the moment is the Brexit vote and its consequences. And that's clearly led to a lot of people wondering how well the democratic institutions are serving us. But I think it's part of a much wider story and a much broader picture, which is what I'd like to talk about, assuming that other people will, you know, fill in my gaps for me and point out where I've gone wrong. So I would say that one of the reasons we actually are experiencing a wobble, a crisis in our levels of trust in institutions is actually because in recent years we've had a massive acceleration in the levels of transparency and scrutiny of our institutions. That is something that I think is very healthy. But, of course, once you start to shine a light on things, you sometimes discover what you wish hadn't been there. And so I think, in a way, we are on a kind of journey as a country, and we're on a journey in our democracies, as to how we deal with the bad things we uncover when we subject our institutions, and indeed our elites, because that's another important part of the story, to more scrutiny and to higher demands. And so I think, you know, there's something good there, increased transparency and the increasing pressure for even more. We've uncovered some disreputable things, some inadequacies, and in some cases even, you know, criminal behaviour, negligences, etc. That's very bad. But the thing I think that's the biggest threat and worry is that this has, that the inevitable dismay and in some cases disgust that this has led to leaves us slightly at a loss as to know where the path might lead in terms of repairing trust, rebuilding our kind of democratic infrastructure, and governance infrastructure, and even how we sort of design a process to get us all to agree on how we repair it. You know, so I think it's really quite a profound challenge that we have. And I just want to run through a few examples that I think have sort of challenged our assumptions in various ways. You know, in the UK, I think for several decades, we were quite complacent about a lot of things, which we're now having to face up to. And some of that complacency was, in fact, about the trustworthiness of our institutions. We had then, in quick succession, the financial crash. The remedies chosen to deal with the financial crash, all of which had the effect of, while stabilising things in the short term, enriching further those with assets, while everyone else had to live through a belt tightening. We then had the MP's expenses scandal, which I think is really interesting to think about today because it's exactly 10 years ago. So we've had 10 years now of Parliament under pressure since the expenses scandal broke. And of course, when that story broke, Parliament then tried to kind of contain it by producing heavily redacted documents and a lot of arguments about invasion of privacy. And it was only because of very aggressive journalism and a leaker handing over a floppy disk, how old-fashioned is that, that we actually, you know, got to the bottom of the expenses scandal, and indeed, you know, some people went to jail. And it was a sort of awful mixture of disgust and ridicule then at our democracy. So I think we're still feeling the effects of that. Clearly, the global recession that followed the financial crash has led to a kind of feeling by many people that the system doesn't work for them. That has had enormous political results and a sort of backwash that's still in play now. And then, actually, if you think about it, there have been other things which I would argue have been as fundamental in this country to how we feel about things. Personally, for me, the worst two stories of the last few years have been the Hillsborough scandal, which actually now is not talked about very much, but that was a really profound shock and challenge to our assumptions about our police and our criminal justice system. And it took 27 years, I think it was, from the first inquest, which chose to say it was an accidental death, to a jury finding that there had been criminal levels of negligence, and then all of the cases against members of the police since then. And also, of course, the collusion between the police cover-up and a major national newspaper. You know, so we've actually had quite a lot of examples of us having to reassess the faith that we had in those who are there to protect and inform us. There's obviously also been, I mean, my industry, the media, has been under a lot of challenge as to whether we have risen to the task. I would argue there are good and bad examples of that, but we've also had the phone hacking scandal, which is was a huge problem for my industry. And, you know, the second trauma that I referred to after the Hillsborough trauma is, of course, the Grenfell Tower. And the reason that I mention that now is because I think that when we're thinking about this crisis of trust, as I've said previously, there are very positive aspects of having this conversation and of this lack of trust, one of which is the end of deference, you know, and people feeling empowered to say this isn't good enough. But then on the other end of that, you have sort of openness to essentially conspiracy theorising, and in Grenfell, I'm afraid, which is an area of London where I live, the lack of institutional response to such a terrible event is still leading to conspiracy theorising, and I think that's something that we need to think about as well.
Thanks so much, Raina. Heading over to Simon for your opening thoughts.
Okay, so in direct contrast to Miranda a bit, I'm not sure that there is a crisis of trust, other than the crisis of trust that is always permanent part of our society. So I'm sure in 50 years' time, when Boris Jr. goes back to Brussels with 150th extension to Brexit, there will be a debate here at the Battle of Ideas about the crisis in trust. There was in the first Battle of Ideas. Actually, I don't know if that's true, actually. I'm sure that it is. You know, someone can check it, but I'm sure that it is. It's an ongoing thing. Oh, I'm sorry. OK. I can can hear myself, but that's probably all I need. it's no better. It's no better now, is it? No. I've just been writing an essay on the mental health crisis, and you probably all share the view there is a mental health crisis. I'm a psychiatrist, and I'm writing on things like due to improved and changing methods of communication, changing patterns in the work, a crisis in politics and political legitimacy, changes in a university structure and education, and so on. Except that I'm actually writing about England in the 1880s, not about now. And all of the things I've just said are perfectly true and were said very much in the 1880s. So it's a constant thing. There have always been. Then there was also a crisis in the Royal Navy because a ship had sunk. There's always been something terrible happening that leads to a crisis of trust. In fact, the only thing really from your opening talk, which I wonder about, you said people are now saying, should we stop trusting Boris Johnson? I wasn't aware that anyone ever did. So I don't think that actually is a crisis. So if we go back to, you know, Mori and all those opinion poll organizations, they make a very nice, handsome living doing these surveys where they repeat all around the world, always using the same question, virtually every year, in fact, looking at these very issues. And they produce these fascinating pictures of how life is changing, how it isn't. And one of them, always they do, is the level of trust, confidence, etc. And they use certain questions, which they repeat, in the professions. And the picture has not changed, apart from one, which will be, I'm sure you'll be talking about actually, apart from one, has been remarkably static now for over 40 years. At the top are always doctors and nurses, invariably with ratings around 85, 90, 95, never changed. At the bottom are always politician journalists with ratings of 3 to 5, 6%, never changed. Indeed, I could just stop at that point and point out to you that I'm a doctor, which I am. Meanwhile, I'm surrounded by Miranda, Tim, Ella, and John, who are all journalists. So I've obviously won this debate now by 90% to 3%, a kind of lead that even Boris won't be able to squander in an election. So it's already over. You trust me, you don't trust them. And we also know that it doesn't really matter what we do. Doctors have been terrible if you watch Bodies and Jed Mercurio stuff, if you follow the Francis Inquiry, you follow all these things. Doctors are constantly betraying that trust all the time. And yet it doesn't make any difference to any of you, which is quite remarkable, but it doesn't seem to you. And people like Miranda have been doing wonderful journalism all of the time, and it doesn't make any difference to her either. So what we do doesn't really seem to affect how we trust. Now, of course, it's pointed out quite correctly that those surveys, in one way, are a bit daft, because it just says, do you respect, would you take advice from, do you trust a doctor? But it doesn't say about what. So I happen to be a doctor, but if you wanted to see a particular doctor, like a neurosurgeon, you probably wouldn't come to see me. And that would be a bit odd, wouldn't it? You wouldn't trust me if I suddenly announced that I'm having finished a psychiatric consultation, I'm going to take a bit of your brain out. Actually, that used to happen a few years ago, but trust me, we really don't do that now. And if you fly to Berlin tonight and the pilot comes on and says, hello, I'm your pilot, I'm actually a trained doctor or a trained nurse, you would think, I never thought Ryanair would go that low, wouldn't you? You'd be a bit surprised that that would happen. So trust actually is not, it ought to be about trusting someone to do something. It's not a statement about me or my profession. It should be about, I trust you to do certain things, but I certainly don't trust you to do others. Okay, and yet that's what we look at, and invariably we score higher. Now, trust in individuals is not the same as trust in institutions. And the other thing that comes perpetually out of all these studies is people seem to differentiate the two without realizing that individuals make up institutions. So people trust doctors very highly and nurses very highly, but they are more suspicious. And if you look at institutions, the NHS always scores, or healthcare systems always scores below doctors and nurses. Police forces always score below the police. Soldiers always score above. I'm sorry, did I get that right? Yeah, I got that right, Ren. Always score above the Ministry of Defence or the Army or the Navy or the Air Force. I'm afraid the only exception is right at the bottom of the barrel, in which people actually seem to trust Parliament more than they do politicians and the media more than they do journalists. Although, having said that, you're at a very kind of base effect there. So a small change in 1% can change that round. But that's, people seem to be more trusting of Parliament than they are of the media. So ultimately, then, I think the crisis of trust, I think, is a constant state of crisis, a permanent crisis, if you wish, rather than a changing one. The only change is in what you're going to talk about in a minute, where there has been a change. And second, I would disagree with Miranda on the solutions. Unora Neal, who gave a brilliant reflection now 20 years ago, and when she opened it, her first lines were, "It appears there is a crisis of trust." That was her first line 22 years ago. And then she said, talking about the solution, she said, and this is 20 years ago, she said, "If the solution was greater transparency, change in laws, or greater regulation, I think we would have seen an effect by now. And as we clearly haven't, the solutions must lie elsewhere." And I think that still remains true.
Great. Thank you. I will keep the microphone, because otherwise I won't be able to tell you to be quiet if you run over. So,
okay.
It's now over to Linda. So, please.
Thanks very much. Simon is right about what he says about the fact that we're not actually losing trust in institutions, we're losing trust in some institutions. And even though the survey questions about trust and confidence are pretty flawed questions, we can at least, they do tell us about change, and they do tell us about national differences, and they do tell us about how very differently we trust some groups of people and some institutions compared to others. So Simon has absolutely rightly pointed out that at the top remain doctors and teachers in about 60%+ trust levels. You leap way down, I'm looking at Ipsos's 2018 figures here, to 11% when it comes to pollsters, government ministers and politicians, on 11%. But that is better, as you say, than clergy and priests, who are now standing at minus 13%. Because the way they do these polls, you get a net score. You can say, do you trust, do you distrust? And you get the net score by putting those together. So there are some people and institutions that get negative scores. So it's very varied. We're actually, I think, much more empirical than is often imagined. We trust some things more than others. And this is where I think I disagree with Simon. I think we actually do have some pretty good reasons why we trust some institutions and professions more than others. But to see that, we need to think, what are we talking about when we talk about trust? I want to offer you a very simple definition of trust. Trust involves two things. It involves, first, the belief that you have my interests at heart, and second, the belief that you're competent to act. So my husband has my interests at heart. He is not always competent to act in order to fulfil those interests, depending on what kind of activity we're talking about. So I trust him in some things, but if it comes to meeting me on time after this, I might not trust him nearly as much. Now, most institutions that we distrust fall at the first of those hurdles, the belief that you have my interests at heart. And there is a very interesting argument, which I find convincing, about why this is. And it was made way back in 1911 by Robert Michels. And some of you, you may not have read his book, which was called Political Parties, but you've heard of what he said. Robert Michels proposed what he called the iron law of oligarchy. And the iron law of oligarchy says that all complex organisations, however democratically they start off, after a while develop into oligarchies. And as you know, an oligarchy is something, it's the rule of the few. So why do institutions have this iron law of oligarchy? Because they quickly stop having the interests of the people they're meant to be serve, so patients or students or the public at heart, and they become much more interested in serving the interests of academics in universities or doctors in hospitals or MPs in parliament. So those of us who are the elites in these places think they're really about making sure that we get well served by these institutions. And because we have more power, we're the few, we are able to make sure they do serve us. And we forget that actually universities are for students and society and so on.
That's the argument of the iron law of oligarchy. I think it's pretty convincing. So when we say that we trust doctors, we still think, going back to my definition, we do think they've got our interests at heart, basically, even though there are some scandals. And we do think that, on the whole, they're competent to act. I mean, you've had a long, long training, so we do kind of trust that that's going to be the case. So what does this mean? In conclusion, what does it mean for institutions? There's one little bit I'd add to the picture here. It's not just my interests at heart, competent to act. It's number three as well. There are safeguards to ensure that you act competently in my interests. And we trust institutions where we think, however badly they've acted, actually they've tried to clean their act up. Mm. We don't think that about the churches. We know they've acted terribly, particularly in relation to abuse scandals, and they have not acted in a way that there is any independent in oversight. And despite constant requests to have an independent oversight that abuse victims or claimants can go to, they haven't acted. So we don't trust that there are safeguards there, or that they're accountable. So I'm arguing that we lose trust on rational grounds. We're very empirical, reasonable people, and that means that we have to ask about all institutions, paraphrasing Ben, some essential questions. For whose interests do you wield power? To whom are you accountable? And how do we get rid of you?
That's great. Thanks so much, Alan. Now, handing over to John.
Thank you, Jacob. I don't any longer consider myself a journalist. I haven't for 4 years, so I'd like to speak outside of that profession, because it's become an absolutely scurrilous profession. And just to give you an example, which just goes to the question of trust. Very soon after Boris Johnson was elected your Prime Minister, he went to visit the President of France, Emmanuel Macron, and they had a conversation which took place in two chairs around two small coffee tables. And the following day in the British newspapers, pretty much all of them that I saw, there was a picture of Boris Johnson with his foot up on one of these tables. And the whole general idea was this Brexit buffoon, that he was there lounging in front of the President of France, letting the country down and so on. Now, this was not just in tabloids. I mean, you expect tabloids, but this was like in The Independent and The Telegraph and pretty much all the newspapers. Now, the next day, a video emerged of this incident, and it was a Reuters video, which showed what happened. And what happened was that President Macron, sitting at the far side of these two tables, made some kind of a joke to Mr. Johnson, saying, you could recline on these tables. And Boris Johnson just lifted his right foot up and gently touched it for a nanosecond, if he did touch it, on the very edge of the table. And then he waved to the journalists and the photographers who were over here, as if to say, sorry, I don't want to mess up your photographs. They had to go through that microscopically to arrive at this moment. Now, what was that? That was a lie. That was a lie. And the thing about it is that everybody just looks at it and they find, even if they find out it's a lie, they shrug and say, what do you expect? So how do you expect your media to do the job that they're there to do when the people who are responsible for this are not horsewhipped in Trafalgar Square? This is what you need to do if you want to actually restore trust to your media. And I'm not just talking about your media. Irish media is worse. That's why I left it. So this question of trust, I think it's actually quite a simple thing, really, because you can see the signs all over the world now in the decay, what the consequences, the backlash in America, the Trump phenomenon, in France, the Gilets Jaunes, in the United Kingdom, Brexit. It comes down to, I think, a couple of universities. There's conversation on later this afternoon at 4 o'clock. What's the point of going to university? It's a really good question. Now, what is the point? Well, if you have an ambition to become a dick, you should go to university. Because there you will learn every kind of bullshit that would be useful to you in furthering a career in bullshit in the modern world. Once upon a time, we had something called a nobility. You had, anyway. We didn't have any money. But they had this concept of noblesse oblige, which still has a currency, ought to have a currency, but maybe doesn't. And that it means, essentially, that you have the privileged have a responsibility to those who were not privileged. There's an obligation to use power in a discretionary and just way so that people that are less privileged will prosper under your rule. That's the general idea. This is gone, and this is the key to it, and the universities are the key to it, because once upon a time, the elite, so-called, they went to nobility, they went to university and they got a classical education, which basically taught them about the civilization they were in charge of and taught them to be civilized, relatively speaking. That was the general idea. Mightn't always have worked, but it was a general, you know, blunderbuss approach. It worked generally well. It has stopped working because of what? Well, because of ideology that has infiltrated the in your university systems. That and the core of it is very easy, and it's visible everywhere now. When I tell you what it is, you'll say, well, that's pretty much everything that we hear every day, all day. Herbert Marcuse, the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory, had an idea called repressive tolerance, which was that essentially tolerance depended on intolerance towards everything that was, that is. In other words, what is real, what is everyday, what is prevailing, what is traditional, what is common sense should not be tolerated, should be subject to intolerance, so that supposedly oppressed and repressed ideas will emerge and that they will have the benefit of tolerance. Well, that's exactly what's happening in our culture now. There's a moral inversion as a result of identity politics, social justice warriors, LGBT. All of these campaigns are essentially turning reality upside down. You know, we're told that, as Douglas Murray has said, you know, that trans is hardwired in the human person. It's hardware. Being a woman is software. It's complete nonsense. But adult people, people of over 5 foot, kind of repeat this stuff. Some of them are judges. You know, it's extraordinary. And this is essentially what's happened, that the concept of noblesse oblige has been disintegrated by all of this kind of stuff. There's a very interesting section here in the blurb. Nonetheless, as perhaps is shown by repeated calls for judge-led inquiries into all sorts of issues, there also seems to be a yearning for trustworthy figures in politics and culture. This is Miranda said we had seen the end of deference. I don't believe we have. This is an example of deference, judge-led inquiry. The idea that judges, of all people, might somehow be able to transcend this culture of bullshit, au contraire. And you had a very recent example, your Supreme Court, 12-0. 12-0 in the most undemocratic interference in the functions of a government that has happened in this country perhaps for a century. 12-0. You see, once upon a time, a judge was somebody who was trained to sift through the fact, to leave his or her personal opinion, subjectivity, to the extent that it was possible, aside, and to weigh up the facts and the evidence. This is a training that you needed to have. But now it's judging has come down to head counts. This is the US Supreme Court. You see, the whole discussion about, in the old days, judges talked about what difference of opinion arose because of differences about the law, interpretation of the law, the meaning of the law. Now they're purely ideological. So it's purely a head count. How many have they, how many have we? In the case of the British Supreme Court, they have 12 and we have nobody. That's what it amounts to. And this is the ultimate result. And you see, that's where you get the Trump supporters. Is it surprising
that somebody would vote for Donald Trump. Is it surprising that the Gilets Jaunes would be now reaching the first anniversary of weekend demonstrations all over France? And is it surprising when you see that here in Britain we've had an oligarchical coup against the democratic will of the British public for 3.5 years, and it still goes on, and there hasn't been, nobody has pulled down the House of Parliament yet. Come on, bring it on. Thank you.
The final opening remark will be from Tim, so your thoughts, please.
It's difficult to follow that, to be honest. They call for the House of Parliament to be so close to Guy Fawkes night as well. I suppose I hate doing this. It's always a bit cheap to question the parameters of the debate. But as some other panelists have already done, so I'm going to go ahead and do it. The limits of trust as a useful concept in this discussion. Is it that useful to think of our current political crisis as a crisis of trust? I'm not sure it is. But before that, trust as a concept is relatively useful as a description of a relationship between individuals, between a relationship between individuals and other corporate entities, individuals and institutions, and it captures the extent to which we imagine, in the absence, I think, of all certainty or guarantees, that another individual or another institution will do as we expect they ought to do. And I think that's roughly what we're speaking about when we're talking about trust. It captures this relationship. So when you trust someone or something, you expect and imagine them to perhaps honour an obligation, to provide a service, and of course to honour a referendum result. Now, that almost feels a bit cheap, even there, to suggest that the absence of trust in some ways resulted in the this refusal on the part of a Remain-dominated parliament to implement the referendum result. There are obviously other things going on there. My problem, I think, with the crisis of trust, or describing things in terms of a crisis of trust, is that you then start to imagine the solution in terms of restoring trust. And Miranda mentioned transparency. The other key buzzword, of course, is always accountability. So that in order to restore trust, we need to make institutions ever more transparent, to make the individuals involved in these institutions ever more accountable. And as Simon said, mentioning Onora O'Neill, she was obviously speaking in 2002, which was 6 years after the, or seven, eight, God, look how trustworthy I am, 8 years after the Cash for Questions scandal, when you initially got this talk of a crisis of trust, this attempt to solve a political problem in terms of restoring trust. So you had Lord Nolan installed as chair of, I think, the Committee on Standards in Public Life. You had a set of principles, the so-called Nolan principles, seven principles, rather obvious stuff for public office holders. You've got to be, you've got to show integrity and honesty, as if you need to be told that, if you need to be told that, there probably is something going wrong. So you had the Nolan principles. He also insisted that politicians make their incomes more publicly available. So you already had the beginnings of a so-called transparency regime. And did that make us trust politicians anymore? No, it didn't do anything of the sort. Again, you had the MP's expenses scandal, which was framed almost entirely in terms of trust, as a breakdown in trust. The solution, somehow make these people appear more trustworthy through transparency, through accountability. There was even a transparency website established in 2010, only lasted for a few months, in which you could see, it basically almost listed politicians' diaries. You could see what gifts they'd received, Theresa May receiving a lovely pair of leopard print shoes. The absolute minutiae of these individuals' largely private existence was being made public. And again, it didn't restore trust. It didn't make us trust these people, these individuals anymore. In fact, and this is, I think, the problem, the principal problem with framing the issue in terms of a crisis of trust is that the regulatory regime which you then impose to restore it institutionalises the very opposite of trust. It institutionalises mistrust. When you think about it, it's kind of obvious because it assumes that these people, unless otherwise surveyed or monitored, will do other than you expect they ought to do. So it serves a coercive function. It assumes in some ways that these individuals are inherently untrustworthy, that unless we are rendering them ever more visible, they will line their own pockets, they will do something wrong against, they'll betray what you have expected them to do. They will betray a promise, a pledge, an obligation, a duty, and so on. So that's my central problem. The regulatory regime, which is often invented to solve the crisis of trust, because you framed the problem as a crisis of trust, makes things far, far worse. As I say, institutionalises mistrust. And I've talked mainly about Parliament, but I think I'd go further. I think the regulation of relationships in the name of restoring trust, and we see this across and in society, I think, more broadly, results in mechanisms and measures which militate against the development of trust. Because if you are regulating that relationship on the basis that these people can't be trusted unless they are otherwise coerced into being so, you are assumed they're not to be trusted. In fact, you are assuming the worst of people over and over again. You are sowing suspicion. You can make an institution or an individual involved in an institution as transparent or as visible to the public as you like, but because you've assumed that they are inherently untrustworthy, you will always think they're hiding something somewhere. So there's always that drive to make their lives ever more transparent, because there's always the belief that something is being hidden. There's always that sense that you are looking at only the tip of the iceberg. And I've used that phrase deliberately because that's the phrase that's always used in certain sectors. I think of child protection and so on, which tend to sow suspicion. They always tend to suggest that there is something more to be found, no matter how much has already been discovered. And you can see that suspicion sowing, that culture of suspicion being cultivated, largely under the auspices of so-called solving a problem of trust. You can see it in all sorts of in sorts of industries, institutions, sectors. I didn't actually trust myself to finish on time. So I think that's my main point. I want to target the regulations, which are the regulatory regime, which is being implemented to solve the problem of trust or the crisis of trust, as being a principal cause for this sense that we are living at a time where trust has never been more absent. I think, to be honest, if you really want to talk about restoring trust, you need to stop thinking of it in terms of regulatory mechanisms, stop thinking of it in terms of transparency and accountability and so on. You have to think of it in terms of allowing people to freely relate to one another and to other institutions. You need to allow people to judge whether someone is trustworthy or not, whether an institution is to be trusted or not, as I suspect some people will do at the next election.
Thanks. So, given that there's five on the panel, I'm not going to pose a question myself, but I think more productive to go straight out to the audience. So, it's hard with the lights as ever to see hands, so I'll ask you to raise them as high as possible. I think the first hand was that lady there who's got a speaker's lanyard and a little shawl on. And then the second mic, where is it? So, this lady in the yellow top will be next. But yeah, you first.
Yes, it was just asking a question about the other way around. I mean, I'm a teacher, and the teaching profession don't trust parents. So, do politicians trust voters? Well, it doesn't look like it at the moment. So I just wanted to ask you about it from the other side. The institutions don't actually trust the people that they're being engaged with, as far as I can see.
Great, thanks. So there's you have the mic. Was there a hand down here? Yeah, so this second mic can go to this gentleman with the moustache, and then that lady can speak.
So I just wanted to talk a little bit about the temporal relationship with trust, and again to sort of pick up on Linda's definition and her example, I think it was you, Linda, of your husband and him being competent and having your interests at heart. I guess on the first date with your husband, you didn't know that about him, at which point there's a degree to which trust has to be earned. We have a very short-term political cycle. We have a lot of institutions comprised of people that turn over at very high rates. Is it an unrealistic goal to ever attain trust in institutions when the people making them up turn over so quickly?
No. There's that gentleman, yeah. So take that mic. Do you take that mic to the back, if you can? Yeah, great. Thank you.
Trust is actually a very weird word, because when you say trust, you're actually assuming that we don't have any agency because we can't think about what people are telling us. When a politician stands up and starts to talk, I don't listen, because I know that they're going to be talking, saying what we want to hear, not what we need to hear. The only politician who ever says anything truthful, whether you like it or not, is Trump. He's the only one that ever says, this is the way it is, and very often turns it into fact. But when you... I used to get the Telegraph, the Times, and the Guardian, and read them together. The Telegraph and the Times, I could read... recognize stories. Very often I'd find the Guardian, the same story would be so different that you would have to say, well, am I reading the same thing? And it's actually up to us to read what we can see and assume, you know, actually take what we're reading and believe it or not believe it. Fake news is just stupid, because you're saying that you're getting all this news out there. Why don't you actually read a variety of things and understand what you're reading and make your own conclusions and then develop your own trust?
Great, thanks. So there's someone with the mic.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then we'll get the panel in briefly and then we'll come back up.
It's been really interested in regarding the trust. I mean, I've talked about the doctor and... you know, yeah, I trust the doctor with my health, but not my car. So it really comes about the individual and the behaviour where compared to... So therefore it comes back to the point made earlier about the competency of the information that's been delivered to you. I think that the issue is, for me, from the panel, what I'm looking for is to really transcend of how do we get past the forgiveness aspect. Yeah, trust is often crossed... yeah, and then it's about getting back to that position of forgiveness and moving on rather than inherently keep going back. 27 years to go back to Liverpool to say sorry to the people is not the timescales we want to be working with. And it's really going back to a much quicker process within our own society of forgiving people like we do in our own families, moving on and getting the best for each other.
I'll get some quick responses from the panel. Miranda, anything to pick up on?
Well, I hugely approve of this gentleman's appeal that everyone should try to exercise their judgment as much as possible. And, you know, I too think it's really important to read lots of different sources of information and to try and get your... I mean, I always talk to schools and universities, etc., I always say read as widely as you can, because you don't want somebody else's prism. You want to see the world clearly, which is often to do with weighing up different points of view and making your own mind up. So I completely agree with that, and I agree also with some of the points that have been made that have hinted towards, in the same vein, that we all actually have a responsibility. I mean, trust shouldn't be blind, right? So we don't want to have some sort of discussion where we're kind of just naively saying that everything should be made utterly perfect and regulations will save us. There's always, you know, room for responsible discretion on the part of each citizen. But I do actually go back to my point. I don't think transparency is some sort of terrible kind of soft cop out. I think I think the reason this feels so painful at the moment is that we're in the middle of a journey where we're starting to look at things more closely. I would like to strongly agree with the lady who talked about short-termism and the short electoral cycle and whether there's time to earn trust. I think that's getting worse rather than better, unfortunately. You know, we've almost become in the UK like America in that it's a permanent campaign in politics. So you just get endless promises because there's never time to deliver. So actually, you're kind of faced, even at this election, I would say, you know, it's only 2 years since the last one and nothing's happened since the last one. So what are we actually being asked to vote on? We're certainly not being asked to vote on any sort of record of delivery, which is what it should be, yeah, you know.
Yeah, just leave that. Tim, I'll come over to you, just I'm looking at you.
Great, yes, fantastic. Yes, the gentleman who raised the issue of our freedom to exercise our judgment, I think that's absolutely key, and that is us exercising our agency. But that also means trusting ourselves, and we have to do that. So we have to respond to, say, the idea that you should certificate certain news outlets as being trustworthy. We have to react to that almost as an insult, because it assumes that we're incapable of judging for ourselves whether to trust or to withdraw our trust from a particular news source or a particular journalist or whoever. In terms of the point made about the teaching profession having a low-down view of parents, I suspect, certainly with, again, that institutional disdain for citizens. OK, in this case, it's teaching profession towards parents, but to return to Parliament, there is clearly institutional disdain towards actual voters. I think that's been quite apparent. And it's, they are unashamed when they talk about what motivated voters to, obviously, well, the majority to vote for Brexit. So you can see that. But again, the only way in which we can, I think, combat that is to, you know, assert ourselves, to continue to assert ourselves, which is to return to my earlier point just then about, you know, determinedly defending our right to freely exercise our judgment.
Great, thanks, Simon.
Yeah, the lady who was a teacher took me back to my childhood. My father was a teacher, and he was also a teetotal, except for twice a year he would come home after parents' evening, open a bottle of whiskey and say, all parents are incurably mad. Anyway, I thought I'd just share one thing, which is coming really from what Tim said and what Jean-Claude over there said about hiding and how that affects trust. I'm the scouts of the British Army, and we've been involved for a long time in improving vaccination rates, which is a debate going on as we speak in another hall. And this is due to the anthrax vaccine, and confidence had collapsed in the anthrax vaccine, and we were asked, what could we do to change this? And one of the problems was that people were told about the side effects of the vaccine, which was based on studies, but no one was ever told about the one thing that all the military feared, was they believed that this vaccine made them impotent. And this is a common belief within military circles, that certain things make them impotent. It's not uncommon. But as that was a completely ridiculous side effect, it was never mentioned. So they decided to change that all. They brought in an incredible system of informed consent, everything you'd all love, greater transparency, greater regulation. You had to sign a consent form. You had to say all the things that you'd take that you've been told about the vaccine, both the true and the false, etc., etc., and rates dropped even lower, even lower. And then when we talked to people, they said, well, there's obviously something unbelievably dangerous about this vaccine, because we don't have to do this for anything else. We get the flu, we get tetanus, we get this and the other. That's, everyone gives us that. This one is obviously the most dangerous thing on the planet. Otherwise, why would they give us all this information, give us this cooling off period, all this stuff? And so basically people stopped taking it completely. And it was only when we changed it again, so this time you sign one consent for all the vaccines, that things got a bit better, but now they don't take it. Why? Now, because they don't think there's a risk, which they're right, but should that risk return, they will then take it. So it then comes back to them exercising their judgment. At this moment in time, they don't think there's a threat from anthrax vaccine, but now at least they agree they would take it if there was. So it's a very subtle thing, but hiding it, which is what you were talking about, that was the worst thing, that when giving them too much information, and that meant they felt this really is dangerous.
Thanks. Yeah, Linda, I'll come over to you.
Thanks for those interesting thoughts. I think that most people are trustworthy, and some people really aren't. And so I kind of agree with Tim that if you take blanket compliant solutions, you tar the majority of people as untrustworthy. And so a successful kind of safeguard is able to focus to focus on the real risk. But we are actually, we have done it successfully in some places. So I disagree with Tim that you can't put this in place effectively. If you look at sexual abuse, we have made enormous strides in tackling that problem in the last few decades, and schools are a good example where what was once a big problem, particularly in boarding schools, has been enormously reduced by putting in place clear safeguards that actually work. And institutions that will not put those safeguards in place have still got a big problem. So I think Tim's being a bit alarmist about saying that we can't think intelligently about the problem and make it focused and targeted to deal with, the few rather than the many who are trustworthy.
Great. John?
The first question about, what they think of us, or do they trust us? Well, they don't have to. They have contempt for us, is really, in all cases, virtually, in political, but certainly in journalism, they have contempt. I mean, there's such a cynicism about journalism now. This is, and I don't know that you can actually be expected as a layperson to see it, because many people trust the masthead of the Guardian or the New York Times or the Irish Times. It's got hundreds of years of tradition behind it and of decent journalism, and now it's gone crazy. All these newspapers are gone completely crazy, and they're printing lies, and they know they're printing lies, and they're quite shameless about it. The way you know is if you're ever implicated in a story yourself, like it's 95% wrong. And that's even before you get to the lies. They just get the color of the car wrong, or, the date wrong, or everything is wrong. But then the lies start, and it's just unbelievable. Everything is twisted. It's quite extraordinary. And this is ideological. This is what I was talking about, this kind of moral inversion, which is related to Mark Hughes's theory. But you see, we shouldn't forget that in all of this, somewhere at the back of this, the God question is there all the time. We haven't referred to this yet, but I'm from Ireland, so Britain is different. I mean, but up to very recently in Ireland, we kind of believed something like this, that Jesus was up there in his control room and he had 8 billion screens, which were connected to CCTV cameras, all of which were directed at each of us, and he was making notes as he went along. And then one day, we all woke up and said, that can't be true. That isn't true. So we don't have to do anything right. We don't have to be good. We don't have to avoid committing sin. We can do what we like. And that's essentially what happened in Ireland. I mean, I remember 25 years ago, there was a few kind of minor bungs to politicians in Ireland, for little things, 500 quid here for a bit of plan, your vote on a planning application or something like that, or rezoning. And then all these tribunals were set up, which were just the most extraordinarily corrupt institutions you ever saw. They went on for 25 years. Lawyers made absolute billions out of them, and they decided that nothing really happened. And while all this was going on, the levels of corruption increased exponentially, and the idea of that is that, well, if they're watching everything so carefully now, I'll be able to get away with murder because they're so busy watching that they won't see me. And that's kind of what happened. And now you find that everything is crooked in Ireland. There's about 500,000, which is a lot of votes in Ireland, 500,000 extra votes on the register that nobody can account for. Which, there's voting in the House of Parliament the last couple of weeks. Basically, they just bang each other's buttons. They don't even look around to see if there's anybody watching. So for the last how many years, nobody knows how many votes are reliable. Yeah. So what I'm saying is, you had this concept here, noblesse oblige, which kind of replaced the God thing. It was a kind of inculcation in a new idea, a secular idea, shall we say, that is now waning because of all this ideology. And just to make this point, about the doctor thing, it's already creeping into this. I find this myself. I spent a lot of time in the hospitals the last couple of years. And having been involved in certain political battles in the last few years in Ireland, I now no longer feel entirely certain if I'm in the room with a doctor or a nurse, is this person a friend, ideologically, or a foe? This is a new thing for me. And it's a new thing in our culture. Okay. That I don't think anybody's cottoned onto yet.
Okay, sure. We'll come out for some more questions on this side. There's a gentleman at the back is waving who did wait. This microphone here, why don't you take it to that lady who's quite near you? Yeah. there. But that gentleman's going to speak.
Yeah. It'd be nice to take John for a drink. I always like meeting people who are more miserable than me. It doesn't happen very often. So thank you for that. Simon, I think, was sort of suggesting that trust's always been a problem. I think if he got Western institutions on the couch, he might find the thing that's different today is that modern institutions in our self-loathing time don't want to be trusted. And they don't want to be trusted because if you trust something, then you're open to abuse. And you know what we're all like. We're very abusive, us people, in the world of extinction and so on. So, because trust is dangerous. You know, how, if people are not good, which we all know they're not in this world, then trust is very dangerous. Authority, if you have trust, you have authority. Authority, we know where that can lead. They don't want trust. So what will happen almost spontaneously is that as soon as an institution has apologized 100 times for 100 things and people start to trust it, they'll have to find something else not to be trusted for.
Great, thanks. There's a lady with a mic. This, can I see some hands? Oh, wait, why don't you keep it? There's a lady there. Yeah, so whoever has the mic.
Yes, I just wanted to make the point that perhaps the issue is much bigger.
Okay, if possible, could people remember to stand up, please, so that the cameras can catch you?
Yes, I just wanted to make the point that perhaps the issue is bigger, going to the noblesse oblige concept and the idea of God, and that if a society does not cultivate virtue and honesty as cardinal virtues, that within any profession and any institution, there will be people who have different cultural values. Now, in this country, we've seen that Tony Blair was a radical liar, got us into a war in Iraq. That was the beginning of the distrust and mistrust, as well as the financial crisis. We have a politician, Keith Vaz, who has shamelessly stayed on gathering his salary for the longest while, has not been criticized by his fellow parliamentarians, is not criticized in the media because, as John says, the standards of people who work in journalism is often very peculiar. I've never seen anybody censor his behavior in the press. So if we as a society cultivated virtue and had an idea of noble attitudes to being and living, then we may not have the problems that we have.
Great. Okay, there's quite a lot of hands out, so I'm going to just run through some people with apologies to the panel. We'll have to somehow sum it all up at some point. But there's a lady with the red mic there. Yeah.
Thank you. So a question to the whole panel. What do you think are the consequences of the mistrust in institutions, and what do you make of the methods used to regain that trust, whether it's censoring of like fake news in the media like some countries do, or like decommercializing research?
Great question, thanks. Okay, so there's someone with a microphone there. This microphone will wind its way down here and everyone will get in, but firstly it'll be that the girl in the stripy top, but there's someone with a mic.
Thank you. I was taken by the idea of the explanation by Simon about trust always being quite low. But one thing I wondered was, one thing that appears to me to have changed, and I wonder what you think, is that the institutions themselves have changed. So it's not that we need to gain trust in old institutions, the institutions are no longer what they were. And what I mean by that is that I think that certainly from the late 90s, organisations that were community-based is probably too strong a word, but rooted as public service, have become businesses. And we have become transactional consumers. And I wonder whether, in that sense, the whole relationship through the process of modernising government in the sense of what Tony Blair was trying to do has actually taken the heart out of those institutions. They are no longer public institutions, and we relate to them as passive transactional consumers, passive, rather than citizens of which these institutions are part of our community to which they are accountable to us. So I don't think it's just a case of now trying to hold those people to account, because the organisations themselves are no longer what they were. So it feels to me a more profound problem.
Thanks. So there's the girl with the stripy top. Then I'm going to see if any one or maybe two people on the panel is desperate to make a quick point.
Yeah, this question is to the entire panel. So basically, we've been talking about trust in institutions, but likewise, I'd like to say the problem is much larger than that. Given that there's more voices, more technology, more amplification today, I think there is largely a distrust in our collective reality. So what do you think about the idea? So I think a few of the panelists have hearkened to this, where they talked about, you know, formerly we believed in God or formerly we believed in nobility. Nowadays, because instead of having one or two, you know, local newspapers, we have, you know, different newspapers with different agendas. We also have Reddit, we have Breitbart, we have, you know, basically because of things, the way the technology has changed and the way the people have changed. And, you know, I'm an American, I'm here in London, you know, people are way more global. There is a collective of different voices, which makes it really hard to suss out, like, what is actually true overall and what is reality. It's no longer possible to use judgment because instead of having one or two sources and being able to do the research yourself, you have, for example, you know, like 40 different sources that say 40 different things. So what do you guys think about the change in how people can perceive a reality and how, you know, the multitude of voices has made it difficult for people to do even simple transactional things in society, which were easy before, and how would we, like, and where do we go from here?
Great, thanks. I just want to get Linda in first, just for a quick
Well, quick response to that really good question. I've just been doing a big study of 18 to 25-year-olds, and you're absolutely right that there is enormous distrust of authority and of institutions. And social media is both the cause and offers a kind of solution. So what people do in response to that is to find much smaller groups who they know are trustworthy. So who you test them out. You test out the friends, the people you like. You can find online people who are a bit like you. You can lurk around a bit. You can listen to how they behave. You can find out where you feel here the trustworthy group of people, which is well moderated. And moderation is a very important invention of a younger generation for dealing with group conversation. And so you withdraw your trust from the big and you bring it to what's within your own ability to understand and trust, I think.
It just creates more polarization.
Yeah, it creates an enormous problem for the institutions to know how they're going to deal with that. And institutions like universities that are on the cutting edge because they work with that age group are really struggling. The communication between university hierarchies and students at the moment is not good.
Okay, there's some quick points just from this side of the panel. We're then going to take some more people down here. We'll get you in for a quick point as well.
But just Socrates actually said you can only ever trust someone you've met. That doesn't always work either. The gentleman over there, who I'd also like to have a drink with, but I think you're completely wrong. Institutions are obsessed with trust now. If you put in, how do we increase trust, the first 500 hits you get are all but all institutions. And finally, but why are institutions, and your point there that things are changing and things institutions we used to like or trust are now declining, I think it's your fundamental point. I thought it was Max Weber, actually, but who said ultimately all institutions will end up protecting their own interests, not the public.
So you have to reinvent them.
Yes, it's a constant cycle of reinventing.
Yeah, another tiny point from John.
Just to pick up the gentleman at the back there, it's a very good point that, you know, trust is dangerous. I agree. I just give you a tiny example. I had an experience with the English and Wales family court system. And what you feel when you go into a system like that is a sense of relief that, the cavalry's here. Well, now justice will prevail. The truth will emerge. I never encountered such corruption in all my life. And what you notice in that system is that the way it works is that the judges essentially are in the business of ass covering. So they just need anybody, any expert, to sign off on anything, no matter how absurd, so that they can cover their ass and say, I got the piece of paper here, this person, it's signed there, and that person's responsible. And when you therefore have an ideological agenda, it becomes impossible to actually get to the truth or to get to justice. And that's actually rife within all of these systems now, because they're entirely ideological.
Okay, great. So some more hands. I want the mic to carry on making its way down here. The other mic, why not take that person at the back? But there's a gentleman there. Yeah. I don't mind who starts, whoever stands up first. Yeah, you, and then you.
I think it's fair to say that a lot of people within the UK mistrust the institutions within the UK. whether it's Parliament or anything, they think there's hidden agendas. Can the panel tell me why people have so much trust in the EU, despite its financial irregularities?
Nice. OK, the mic will carry on down this way. Yeah.
I have a quick question for John. If people go to university to become dicks and they get a PhD, what does that mean? I'm asking for a friend. But I did just want to bring up the relationship of trust and hope, because I think there were times when people did trust in institutions. The early 1960s in the United States under JFK is a period whereby people had faith in all of the institutions, in politics, in business, and in unions and everything else. And I think it's because it's a much more hopeful time. People think that things are going to go their way, so therefore they trust the institutions to get them there. So I think ultimately that stopped historically in the mid-60s and 70s, and that's when it's changed. It's actually a historical kind of issue, and I would like the panel to address that, please.
Great, thanks. So there's someone with the mic. This mic can then come back down and try and help out here. Let's take this person. A couple of quick thoughts from Tim and Miranda, and then more from the other.
I'd say there's something a bit different about distrusting institutions today, even if their levels are fairly constant, and that is the extent to which distrust of institutions, it strikes me, are a projection. It's a projection of our distrust of each other, and that has something quite a lot to do with lives being more privatised, there being less sense of collective community or solidarity, but it's also because, to a considerable extent, the institutions have taught us to distrust each other, have schooled us to think of ourselves as either victims or perpetrators, and have moved from a time 30 years ago when there were only institutionally recognised a tiny minority of eggshell skulls who would have been persuaded to act violently because they'd seen a violent video, whereas now 63 million people allegedly are fooled into acting toxically and voting for Donald Trump. And I think that just is a measure of the extent to which there is now this kind of call and response between fearful people and institutions which encourage us to be more and more fearful of each other and of the institutions themselves. Yeah. What's brought it all on? Well, quick point about this. Francis Fukuyama, you've got to be careful how you say that, wrote The End of History, and then the next book he did was on trust. And I do think that there is not just a chronological relationship between them, that the sense of trust which is engendered when people have a sense of themselves as history makers is absolutely dissipated. I think we're suffering from the lack of it.
OK, so I want to get Tim and Miranda just to respond briefly to a couple of points. Then I want to remember that Johan, so pass that mic along to that lady or this gentleman. We'll just take these people after Tim around.
I love all the questions about sort of zeitgeist and whether we're projecting and our own sort of lack of trust in each other. I don't have the answers to any of your questions, but I think it's really thought-provoking, so I'd just like to thank you, and I'll go away and think about it, particularly the one about the relationship between trust and hope and whether it's actually part of an expression of some much deeper unhappiness at the moment, which I suspect is true. In fact, one of the other conversations I've been part of this afternoon was actually about how all of our political conversations are going wrong because we're all talking about our own private dystopian fear, and that's why we're not communicating. I think there's a lot of interesting things going on there. I just wanted to come back to a point that was made about cultivating virtue in the public realm, and I think that's actually really important conversation because, you know, I mean, I suspect, for example, Tim and I disagree on a lot of the framing about this question, but, you know, there are bad actors. And so you kind of need, as a society, to crowd out the bad actors by an expectation of good behaviour. But you do have to have that reinforced in some way, you know. And I think one of the things that's gone wrong, perhaps in how we relate to each other, as this gentleman here was saying, was, you know, people see, for example, in investment banking, I mean, what is investment banking? You look for two things, suckers and loopholes. That's what the business is, you know. And if that's lauded in our society and rewarded so greatly in our society, what's the general message?
Right, Tim, a quick thought.
Yeah, quickly. I think someone said, why do people place such a large amount of trust in the EU? The rather obvious answer, I think, is because those that do trust the EU because they really do distrust their fellow voters. I think that's why. They believe that the EU will do what they do not believe their fellow voters and their own potential institutions of self-governance will be able to do. Hence, they talk about the EU protecting things all the time, be it workers' rights, because, of course, there is no tradition in the UK of ever defending and standing up for workers' rights. You know, no such thing as a labour movement or a trade union movement or any of those things. It's all down to the EU. So what I mean is there is this belief that the EU can do things which a domestic electorate cannot do because I'll rephrase that. The trust in the EU is born simply not so much because of the EU's own merits as a technocratic institution, because of a deep distrust of the British polity and of democracy. I think that's what that's born of. Fear of social media, quickly. I think the fear of social media, I'm always worried about this fear of social media. In some ways, I don't have a problem with a vital public sphere, and social media is part of that, questioning and calling power to account or calling things into question. Well, there should be no problem with that. Obviously, I think there are problems with social media in terms of echo chambers reinforcing one's prejudices and one's received opinions. But as I say, I think the main thing is I'd like to defend social media in this case in terms of its enlarging that sphere of criticism and questioning and so on. And I'd probably say that the fear of social media amongst... the fear of social media, I'd liken it to the fear of the growing reading public during the 18th century. I think that's a serious problem.
Okay, great. So we're going to start with this lady, who's then going to pass it to that guy, and we've got a few people as well. So, yes.
I'd just like to come in a bit on the point about the church and slightly contest the idea that it's completely not trusted at a local level. So from my experience, I work for a charity that coordinates Church of England-based social action. We know that 70% of Anglican churches, for example, do two or more toddler groups, food banks, all those different things. And I was also part of a church in East London that coordinated a campaign for community-led housing, and we had Muslims, Christians, people of no faith coming together and actually saying that the church was a place where they could come together in community, where there are few other spaces for people to meet and build relationships. And that idea of kind of public virtue, actually the church often really cultivates and encourages its members to look outwards. And perhaps a question to Linda, I don't know if you've got any kind of reception, or that's something, that kind of expansion in the church's social action, I'm just talking from a Church of England perspective, for example, whether that ever kind of into that idea that, of course, with things like sex abuse scandals, that maybe clergy are not trusted in a kind of Ipsos poll, but actually maybe at a local level, there's a difference between local institutions and the kind of the way that the church is nationally perceived, for example.
Yeah, okay, so there's the lady with the mic. You're going to pass it to that gentleman there.
I want us to go back to accountability and justice. Human beings will always make mistakes. We're not perfect, and we make up those institutions. Mistakes will always be made, but if we don't see those people having the right punishment, then there's no sense that this wrongdoing at the very top is meeting justice. I mean, every scandal you've talked about, we haven't seen justice. And really, if the people holding those people at the top to account are all part of the same social sphere who've moved up through lack of other social mobility, and they're all part of the same network, so there's a revolving door between institutions and the regulators, or those people who hold those institutions to account. Can we ever really have true justice? Those people at the top aren't meeting, you know, their just punishment.
Okay, great. So who has the mic? Yes. Yeah, you're going to pass it to the gentleman behind you. It'll then go to that lady there. But
yes, following up on that theme, I believe a main problem with trust is too high expectation that people are always going to do the right thing. People in charge are going to do the right thing. And I firmly believe that trust is better built when you actually fail. And when you fail and you go out boldly and you say, this is how I failed, this is all the events that led to my failure, and then you say, I'm going to put these processes in place, and I'm going to process, and I'm going to promise, not that I'm never going to fail again, but I'm never going to fail again in the same manner. And this is how I believe that you build trust. And this is, I think, the most important part. And this is the main theme in the Hillsborough disaster or in the church scandal. It wasn't the tragedy of the mistake itself. It was the hide-up and that people were trying to avoid mistakes. So my question is, how do we make sure that in leadership and in all levels of the institutions, people, you create a culture in which people are able to own their mistakes and to detect the mistakes early. And more, even, probably more importantly, in the general public, that they're going to accept that mistakes are going to be happen. Don't expect your leaders always to be perfect.
Great, thanks. Okay, so there's the lady with the mic. I'll then go forward. Is there anyone else who's desperate to get in? Yeah, okay, so it'll be that gentleman as well. So there's these two people and that gentleman, then the panel will have a minute to close.
Just to mention another culprit, the ethics of...
Can you stand
of,
up, please, if possible?
Yeah, Albenes Manova.
Can you stand up for the microphone?
Sorry. Yeah. Just to suggest another culprit, you mentioned that the ethics of noblesse oblige have vanished, but they have been replaced by the ethics of meritocracy. Now, that was a very negative term. It was a pejorative term invented by the sociologist Michael Young in 58 to describe a dystopian British society where divided between the few merited, high-minded power holders and the rest a society of losers. Now, these power holders that merit because of their personal achievement and good education, they actually rule with a sense of entitlement. So when, and curiously, the British political class adopted that term as a label, like Tony Blair was very proud to be called a meritocrat.
Great, thanks. So you'll pass it forward to that gentleman. There's a person with a mic will speak while you're moving over. Yeah.
This is just a question about psychiatry, actually. So it's aimed towards the professor. I think there are more connections between psychiatry and journalism than you might think. Psychiatry relies, to a large extent, on arbitrating reality. So if I say I'm the Queen of Sheba, it means I'm ill, and I'll get some tablets and various treatments. If I say, I mean, obviously, being gay was once an illness, and that had enormous political ramifications. I mean, the modern-day equivalent is if I'm a man and I say I'm a woman, that's accepted. Well, in some quarters, anyway. And psychiatry, it seems curiously silent on this particular topic. I'm just curious as to why.
Okay, great. So I think this gentleman's going to be the last person unless there's someone absolutely desperate. No.
Hi, yes. Just going back to what Simon said at the beginning about different trust in different people in professions, so doctors are always more trusted than politicians. What happens, just a thought in my mind, but what happens when a politician or where a doctor then sort of decides, like Sarah Wollaston, to try their hand at politics? Do they immediately lose their trust points? Or because they're the same person after it, so, you know, how does it go? And with, I suppose. And with more people sort of trying their hand at getting into politics from other professions, does it lead to a sort of politicisation of these of these otherwise sort of supposedly neutral institutions? Just a thought in my mind.
Okay, so the panel are going to have literally a minute, and I will accept no more to sum up. But first, I just need to make a quick announcement. The first is that you can stay in here for the keynote after this, which is picking up this gentleman's question on hope, and we're going to be discussing extinction or progress visions for the future. So you can stay in here for that. But the other things I should tell you about is that if you want to stay in touch with the Academy of Ideas, and you've enjoyed the Battle of Ideas so far, and you want to be informed of future events and meetups and things like that, please follow us on Twitter or Facebook or go to www.battleofideas.org.uk/subscribe, and you can also find out about a wide variety of other projects and programs that we're running, not least if you go to the page in the thing on the keynote. It says something called Living Freedom. There's also an advert for something else called the Academy. They might be of interest. If so, do let us know. But yes, well, I'll go to the panel in the order that we started, and they'll just have literally a minute to sum up. So Miranda, what's your closing thoughts?
Well, I love the gentleman's question about creating some sort of culture where you can actually confront the mistakes that have been made and move on and learn from them. I think in a way that's what all institutions, all companies, all employment environments would like to have. in a way, there's a kind of terrible mismatch between a lot of guff that's talked about, you know, celebrating failure and we can all learn from failure. And, you know, this is the great sort of management business school nonsense at the moment. Whereas, of course, in practice, we all know that people are punished for their failures and their mistakes. So I think that's a genuinely good question to raise. But a lot is talked about it without realising that in practice, that's not what happens. And on this quite interesting question about, you know, Sarah Wollaston's the same person when she was the local MP as when she was the local GP, but somehow we think she's an appalling, contemptuous, disdainful person because she's gone from one to the other. Yeah, I don't think she is a different person. I think she's just trying to serve her community in a different way.
Okay, perfect. That was a minute, so thank you. Simon.
Okay, I mean, we need trust to survive in the world. Without trust, there would be nothing. We wouldn't be able to do all the various things that we're not competent to do. We wouldn't have love. We wouldn't have anything without trust. And we have to find it somewhere. Otherwise, the world just will cease. And the greatest enemy of trust is probably fear, actually. And the point you were making over there about fear and trust, the most dangerous policy no one has actually mentioned at the moment, which is making children frightened of strangers. The stranger danger policy in our schools is going to do a terrible harm to the next generation. And so I want to end with the words of an American president, and it's actually Ronald Reagan. Do you remember the good old days when we used to make fun of his syntax? Sounds like Goethe or Shakespeare now, doesn't he? Anyway, but he said at the end of the SALT talks about which would bring the world to a safer place in terms of risk of nuclear war, he used the words, what we need to do is trust but verify. That's the best we can do.
Mm-hmm. Great, thanks. Linda.
Okay, so to the lady about churches, yes, it's absolutely true that we trust more where we've had a personal, meaningful contact. But the trouble for the Church of England is that so few people now have a personal contact with a priest, which is very different from the past. So you get your impression through the media. And they often hear much more about anti-gay, anti-women and so on. We have, I think, been taking quite a short-term view, and that's why we're feeling pessimistic, because the gentleman who said that trust was very high in the post-Second World War era is completely right. And our statistics only begin in the 1950s, so they started off at this really high point. But imagine we asked a question on a survey, a trust survey, in 1929 or 1930, and the question was, do you have confidence in the bankers and the politicians and the elites? Imagine how incredibly low the trust level would be then. So trust goes in waves, and if we just measure it against the start of the statistics, we're always going to be incredibly sceptical. I am also much more optimistic than some of you, therefore, because we can reinvent institutions and we've all got some agency to do that and we need to just get on with it.
Great, thanks. Linda, John.
The question about why people trust the EU goes to the question, I think, centrally. I don't believe they do. It's a case of my enemy's enemy is my friend. It's another example of the contempt that, you know, because the EU bankrupted half of Europe in the past decade, including my own country, and it's a completely reckless route, all in the interest of the German economy. It created the euro, which was designed for Germany and nobody else, and destroyed half of Europe, and we're still cleaning up the mess with Lega and Gilles Jeans and all that. There's a book out there in the Barbican shop, there's a little section for books, and there's a book called, I think it's called National Populism, The Challenge to Liberal Democracy, by two guys called, I think, Matthew...
Goodwin
and Simon Eatwell, is it?
Anyway, Roger.
Yeah. Roger, right, that's, yeah. There's a section where they deal with this question of that trope that emerged after Brexit was, you know, that the people who voted for Brexit were basically numbskulls and the people who had voted to remain were the intelligent people, you know. And they deal with this question of education. And what they really concluded, and which I think is absolutely true, that the question of university is not that you go to be educated, or whether you are or not is not the point. What you go in and you belong to clubs, you hear the same views from everywhere. You come out thinking the same thing as everybody else, and you belong to those clubs, to those aristocracies for the rest of your life. That's essentially the difference, that this question of education and the contempt and the question of us and them is defined by this, and the trust crosses or doesn't cross that divide.
Okay, thanks, Sean. Tim, final word to you.
Ideally, I'd like to end with Keith Vowes, who, of course, I think poses a plumber, and tie that into a clever comment on checkatrade.com. But unfortunately, I don't have the mental gymnastics to be able to do that. So I think I just end by saying trust
as someone mentioned right at the back, always involves risk, because it's a relationship that you enter into in the absence of guarantee. And I think you can't simply conjure trust into being through certain regulations, certain measures, and so on. To be honest, I wish I'd ended with Keith Vaz, because I'm just reiterating some of my earlier points. So I'm going to end there. Actually, keep it short.
Okay, thanks. Can we thank the panel?